The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. The issue from which I will begin today is Time, dated September 27/October 4, 2021. As is typical, the front cover is banded in red and then double banded on the inside in white, with Time in large block letters in black, superimposed upon a woodsy-looking background upon which there's a portrait of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. This particular issue includes Time's identity or identification of the world's 100 most influential people, from which I will take another handful to read to you. I will not read all of them. With Time permitting, I will then return to the previous issue, dated September 13/September 2021, for further feature and news articles. First of all, from the current edition, the brief postcard. What's behind China's common prosperity slogan? By Charlie Campbell, Shanghai. In a sign of how far its leaders have drifted from their revolutionary roots, the biggest shock currently gripping China is that the ruling Chinese Communist Party, CCP, might be socialist after all. That is because the mantra, common prosperity, first introduced by Mao Zedong, has been taken up by current strongman, President Xi Jinping. Xi used the term 15 times while addressing top officials August 17, declaring common prosperity a key feature of Chinese-style modernization. Official media says the goal is to build a fairer China by reducing income inequality. Nobody doubts the CCP also wants to use the campaign to reassert authority over China's digital high flyers. Billionaires and tech companies are very risky to the CCP because they're seen as an alternative form of social and political power, says David Moser, an associate professor at Beijing Capital Normal University. All this makes the markets nervous. Up to $1 trillion has been wiped off the valuation of Chinese firms since February, after regulators began targeting electronic payment providers, real estate developers, private tuition companies, a $120 billion industry in education-hungry China, and the gaming sector. The latter generated $44 billion in earnings last year. It is now reeling from directives banning children from playing more than 3 hours of online games a week. The party-run People's Daily ran an editorial September 8 saying the moves are not designed to hurt businesses, not long after a senior CCP official said common prosperity does not mean killing the rich to help the poor. But there is no denying some of the biggest socioeconomic changes since reformist leader Deng Xiaoping unleashed market forces in 1985 with the now infamous words, "Let some people get rich first," are underway. Many forget that Deng went on to say that those who did get rich would be expected to pay it forward. His successors look poised to make good on that bargain. Rumors are swirling. Beijing may bring in property, inheritance, and capital gains taxes to level the playing field in a society where the top 1% now control 31% of wealth. Having already declared absolute poverty in China eradicated, Xi, in July, reaffirmed the goal of building a modern socialist country that's prosperous, strong, democratic, culturally advanced, and harmonious by 2049, the centenary of the People's Republic. Of course, democratic means different things in China than in the West, but there's little doubt the goal of a socialist country is more important to Xi than it was to his immediate predecessors. Xi does not want to be seen as someone who's in league with these giant tech companies and billionaires, so he is cracking down, explains Moser. It's a populist move, so ordinary people feel the CCP is on their side. Unsurprisingly, China's wealthiest have been throwing money at the problem, pouring billions into charitable foundations as a gesture of appeasement. Jack Ma's e-commerce giant, Alibaba, has pledged 100 billion yuan, $15.5 billion, to fund Common Prosperity Initiatives through 2025. That came after an earlier pledge of 100 billion yuan from Tencent and 10 billion yuan from bosses at tech giants Pinduoduo, Xiaomi, and Meituan for various social projects. And many of the country's most famous tycoons have quietly stepped back from boardroom positions in recent weeks to take roles with a social focus. ByteDance's Zhang Zemeng, JD.com's Richard Liu, and Pinduoduo's Colin Wang have, like Ma before them, backed out of the limelight. The fact of the matter is that these people are excessively rich, says Moser, and donating a little bit of that money is not going to hurt them. Moving now to some of the profiles of some of Time's 100 most influential people, and beginning with someone who was referenced in the last article, Xi Jinping, dominant autocrat. A photo of him here in a blue suit with a white shirt and red tie against a red background. He has a podium in front of him with four microphones. This is written by Sakiagin Elba Dorge. I have met with President Xi Jinping around 30 times. We have chatted one-on-one on some occasions, but for the sake of time and space, I would like to highlight three points when I talk about President Xi. That's X-I. First, President Xi loves his country and his people dearly. When he invited me to China for a state visit, I asked him where I should go while there. He replied, "Come visit my ancestral home in Shaanxi Province. It's a wonderful place." I added I wanted to visit Inner Mongolia and meet a local family. He again replied very kindly. Second, President Xi has no arrogance. He treats people or counterparts from other countries as equals, although there's no doubt that he's the most influential politician in the world today. Third, I have no illusions about President Xi's policy as a whole. I totally disagree with what the Chinese Communist Party is doing to ethnic minorities in China. When it comes to Mongols in China, they have a distinct way of life, culture, and language. They have constitutional and human rights to enjoy, to inherit. These rights must be protected. Chinese assimilation policy, which has also targeted the Uyghur minority, detaining more than an estimated 1 million in government camps, has no future. China cannot claim humanity while committing crimes against humanity. He demonstrates, as many in history have before him, that it is possible to be charismatic in person and dangerous and autocratic on the world stage. He can be benign and evil. So let's face President Xi. The author of this short article, Elbegdorj, I'm going to spell that, I really apologize for mispronouncing it, Elbegdorj, is a former president of Mongolia. Donald Trump, Threatening Democracy, by Nancy Gibbs. Again, a portrait here of former President Donald Trump standing on a stage somewhere, dressed in navy blue, white shirt, red tie. Looks like he's applauding, and in the background there is a large crowd of people. This is probably outdoors because I see a darkening, cloudy sky behind Mr. Trump. On his very first day as president, Donald Trump stood on hallowed ground at the CIA and boasted of holding the all-time record in the history of Time magazine for being on the cover. That record is actually held by Richard Nixon, the other modern president in competition for doing the most violence to values, norms, honor, and decency undergirding American democracy. In 2021, Trump arguably surpassed Nixon as a menace to the Constitution. American democracy catches its breath in between lines of the founding text. It depends for its resilience and moral power on a shared commitment to both individual freedom and the common good. Trump's only rule is ruthlessness. He sees norms as opportunities for vandalism, a window left open in our intricate constitutional structure that he can crash through. Trump's assault on the Justice Department, his extortion of foreign allies, his obsession with domestic enemies, all rhyme with Nixonian villainy and go further. Nixon had his secret enemies list. Trump called for his congressional opponents to be arrested for treason. Nixon largely kept his bigotry private, coded in the language of the silent majority. Trump made his a slogan. And in 1960, despite actual evidence of election fraud in Illinois and Texas, Nixon did not summon his supporters to storm the Capitol. Trump celebrates participants in the January 6 insurrection as patriots and runs to get another can of gasoline. Although he has left office, he remains a magnetic force, propelling others who've taken up his anti-democratic mantle and challenged the validity of our elections. Nixon still leads Trump by a count of 55-35 in the Time cover competition. But history will judge which president most disfigured our politics and polity. That's a race Trump is well positioned to win. The author Nancy Gibbs is director of the Shorenstein Center, the Edward R. Murrow Professor at Harvard Kennedy School, and a former Time editor-in-chief. Rochelle Walensky, Following the Science, by Julie Gerberding. The SARS-CoV-2 pandemic is not the first time U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky, that's spelled W-A-L-E-N-S-K-Y, has served on the front lines of a daunting public health challenge. Positions, like her role as a Harvard University clinician investigator, have contributed to a career punctuated by numerous important research contributions to controlling HIV infection, a long-standing threat to people across our nation. Dr. Walensky's calm courage and proven track record of respecting science, the essential foundation of good public policy, are restoring the CDC's prominence in leading us through this pandemic. The breadth of her experience and commitment to health equity will no doubt translate to effective leadership in addressing the broader, enduring health challenges we face. There's a very small, dark portrait, a headshot of Dr. Walensky here. She's wearing a dark, probably suit, but we see only the top of her jacket. gray beads. She has dark hair. It's brushed, it's parted and then brushed mostly to one side. She has dark eyes, dark eyebrows, rose-colored lips, and what look like spiral silver-colored earrings. Gerberding, who wrote the article, is an executive vice president at Merck and a former director of the CDC. Adar Poonawalla. Poonawalla is spelled Poonawalla. Betting Big on Vaccines by Ibishyant Kidongkur. Portrait here of Adar Poonawalla. A gentleman dressed in a dapper gray, almost windowpane plaid suit. What looks like a pale pinkish-white shirt, a brown tie, brown shoes. He has very dark hair, combed back, and brown eyes. He's looking straight at the camera. From the beginning of the pandemic, Adar Poonawalla sought to meet the moment. His company, the Serum Institute of India, was already the world's largest vaccine maker when he promised 1.1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines for the developing world by the end of 2021. That assurance was the backbone of the plan for global vaccine access, mounted by a coalition of institutions, including the World Health Organization. Poonawalla told me in March he did not want to have regrets when history judges my actions. But over the course of this year, a series of issues, a fire at his plant in Pune, India, trouble securing necessary raw materials, and a vaccine export ban amid India's second wave of COVID-19 slowed his ambitions and left many countries scrambling to find other sources of the vaccines. The pandemic's not over yet, and Poonawalla could still help end it. Vaccine inequity is stark, and delayed immunization in one part of the world can have global consequences, including the risk of more dangerous variants emerging. Meanwhile, the Serum Institute has almost doubled production of COVID-19 vaccines since May and is adding newer vaccines, including Novavax and Russia's Sputnik V, to its portfolio in the coming months. Whether Poonawalla can right the ship this time will determine which side of history he falls on, and more importantly, how quickly the world emerges from the pandemic. The writer of this, Kidongkur, is a Time producer. Liz Cheney, standing firm. She's portrayed here in a gray suit. She's blonde, wearing glasses, standing in front of a building that looks like something in Washington. Perhaps it's the Capitol. By Cindy McCain. Rare are politicians who do not claim to put country before party. Rarer still are those who actually have. Representative Liz Cheney, a rock-ribbed Republican raised by unflinching conservatives, is the rarest species of politician yet, the ambitious officeholder who risks her office to speak the unwelcome truth to her own side. My late husband enjoyed a reputation for political independence. When John was alive, he was dedicated to the dignity of the truth, just as Liz Cheney is today. By insisting that the 2020 election had been free and fair, that the January 6 assault on the Capitol was an assault on America's democratic character, and that President Trump bore responsibility for it, she set an example of selfless patriotism that will endure long after her own ambitions are at rest. Representative Cheney knew, as John did, that parties cannot define a nation's political character. We are all protected by the same Constitution, the same democratic values, and as she faithfully maintained, we must be brave enough to defend them. Cindy McCain is a philanthropist and author. Joe Biden responding to crises by Bernie Sanders. In the midst of a horrific pandemic, economic collapse, grotesque levels of income and wealth inequality, racial tension, extreme weather disasters, and dangerous attacks on American democracy, President Joe Biden came into office with a willingness to think big, not small. Joe Biden and I have strong disagreements, but it must be acknowledged he's the first president in a very long time who's attempting to address the fundamental crises facing our nation. In doing that, Biden is restoring faith among ordinary Americans that their government can work for them and not just for wealthy campaign contributors. Biden's bold American Rescue Plan created a strong vaccine program that will save tens of thousands of lives, alleviate hunger and homelessness, reduce the child poverty rate by more than half, and help revitalize the economy. Now, through two unprecedented pieces of legislation, the infrastructure bill and the budget resolution, he's leading the effort to create millions of good-paying jobs by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, address the long unmet needs of working families, and tackle the existential threat of climate change. I look forward to working with President Biden on these transformative efforts. Sanders is an independent and a U.S. senator from Vermont. Mario Draghi, Draghi, A Stabilizing Force by Janet Yellen, Yellen. The speeches of central bankers are not typically very quotable or inspiring, but Mario Draghi's July 2012 remarks in London were an exception. He famously declared, "The European Central Bank would do whatever it takes to preserve the euro," which of course it did. Mario and the ECB helped stabilize the European economy. At the time, I was at the Federal Reserve and felt particularly grateful to have a partner like Mario across the Atlantic, someone with deep expertise and a steady demeanor. Now, the U.S. is grateful to have Mario as a partner once again, this time as Italy's prime minister. Mario's guiding his nation through the pandemic with a deft hand, championing a swift vaccination campaign and relief measures to help Italian businesses and workers. Backed by a large allotment of EU funds, he has set in motion many necessary and politically difficult policies and investments to green the Italian economy, reduce inequity, and advance digitalization. And with Italy leading this year's G20, Mario's bringing together the world's major economies to end the pandemic, promote an inclusive global recovery, and tackle pressing global issues like climate change. It has been 9 years since his famous speech, but Mario's "do whatever it takes" approach is more relevant and inspiring than ever. Janet Yellen is U.S. Treasury Secretary. Roger Cox, COX, Climate Litigator by Al Gore. May 26, 2021 may go down in history as a turning point toward accountability for the fossil fuel industry and its central role in creating the climate crisis that threatens our way of life. That day, while American companies ExxonMobil and Chevron faced unprecedented rebukes from their own shareholders, in the Netherlands, attorney Roger Cox helped set an even more significant precedent, winning a David versus Goliath legal battle against Royal Dutch Shell that requires it to reduce its emissions 45% by 2030. The Dutch court's ruling sent shockwaves through corporate boardrooms around the world, marking the first time a company's been held legally accountable to the Paris Agreement. Acting on behalf of more than 17,000 Dutch citizens, Cox's innovative approach drew upon the latest climate science, breaking important ground that could compel businesses around the globe to act ambitiously to safeguard the well-being of future generations. This victory, paired with Cox's previous landmark case that forced the Dutch government to reduce its emissions 25% by 2020, shows we do not need to wait for slow progress on intangible goals. We have the ability and the precedent to demand concrete climate action now. Al Gore is former vice president of the U.S. and founder and chairman of the Climate Reality Project. Narendra Modi, M-O-D-I, taking more control, by Fareed Zakaria. In its 74 years as an independent nation, India has had three pivotal leaders. Jawaharlal Nehru, its founding prime minister, set the template for the country as secular and democratic. Indira Gandhi presided over its most tumultuous times, spanning war, civil strife, and emergency rule. Narendra Modi is the third, dominating the country's politics like no one since them. After mishandling COVID-19, the death toll has been estimated to be much higher than the official count. His approval rating has slipped to a still sky-high 71%. When he was elected, many believed Modi would finally move India off its socialist past and into a capitalist future. He has done some of that, but more determinedly, he's pushed the country away from secularism and toward Hindu nationalism. In addition to eroding the rights of India's Muslim minority, Modi's government has imprisoned and intimidated journalists who shine a light on its abuses and has passed laws crippling India's thousands of NGOs and advocacy groups. It was responsible for 70% of internet shutdowns on the planet in 2020. Two international think tanks concluded this year that under his watch, India's veered away from democracy toward what V. Dem Institute calls electoral autocracy. Modi must decide if that is what he wants as his legacy. And Zakaria, is host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS. Naftali Bennett, convening an unlikely coalition, by Mansour Abbas. In the end, it all comes down to courage. After four elections in 2 years, a bold act was needed to unite a country frayed by political stalemate and brought to a desperate standstill. Something dramatic needed to change, but more importantly, someone courageous needed to make that change. Naftali Bennett threw himself into a political firestorm in order to forge previously unimaginable ties between Israel's left and right, Arabs and Jews, religious and secular. He formed one of the most diverse governments in Israel's history. "I don't do things in the dark," Bennett, who's now prime minister, told me in a meeting with him in the Knesset that he agreed to be made public. "As leader of an Arab party, I'd become used to cameras being kept outside the room. In a time of polarization and hate," Bennett said, "the Israeli public needs unity." It wasn't just the flash of the cameras that lit up the room at that moment, but the hope for a brighter future for us all. Mansour Abbas is leader of Israel's United Arab List party. Mahbuba Seraj, S-E-R-A-J, A Voice for Afghan Women, by Roya Mahboob. There are so many things to admire about Mahbuba Seraj. In 2003, she left a comfortable life in the U.S. to return to her native Afghanistan. There she fought for the rights of women at a time when fewer than 10% of girls were enrolled in elementary school. The founder of the nonprofit Afghan Women's Network, she's dedicated herself to championing children's health, battling corruption, and empowering victims of domestic violence. When the Taliban returned to power this August, she headed not to the airport, but to work. She decided to remain in Kabul to test the claims of the new rules that this time they will not sideline and demean half the population of a country that needs every one of its citizens to realize their potential. Her uncompromising clarity may be what I most admire about Mahbuba Seraj. Asked, "Are you okay?" she will reply, "No, I'm not okay." She says the thing all of us feel, and then she acts. Roya Mahboob is an Afghan tech entrepreneur and founder and CEO of the Afghan Citadel Software Company. The subject of the article, Mahbuba Seraj, is photographed here. She has long, gray, almost white hair, bright brown eyes, pinkish lips. This is a headshot. She's wearing white with an elegant green damask scarf around her neck. Tucker Carlson, a man with brown hair, wearing a plaid shirt, with paneled walls behind him, sporting a large U.S. flag hanging from one of the walls. Tucker Carlson, Rallying the Right, by Charlotte Alter. Love him or hate him, Tucker Carlson may be the most powerful conservative in America. With roughly 3 million viewers every night, Tucker Carlson Tonight is the top-rated show in cable news history. As Republicans have lost nearly all their political power on the federal level, Carlson's emerged as the de facto cultural leader of the right. His diatribes against the elites, the federal government, and the scientific consensus shape the belief system of millions. If it seems like Americans cannot agree on anything, including whether COVID-19 vaccines work and whether Joe Biden won the presidential election, that's partly the evidence of Tucker Carlson's influence. Charlotte Alter is a Time senior correspondent. Ebrahim Raisi, R-A-I-S-I, Hardline Cleric, by Karim Sadjapur. When Ebrahim Raisi, an unremarkable 60-year-old cleric, was anointed Iran's president in an engineered June 2021 election, the decisive vote was cast not by Iran's population, but its 82-year-old supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's ruled since 1989 and sees in Raisi a loyal supplicant and potential successor. Raisi's resume was honed in the 1980s when he was complicit in the execution of thousands of political prisoners and religious minorities. As president, his already limited popularity will further decline as he becomes accountable for a broken economy, ravaged by mismanagement, sanctions, and COVID-19 that he cannot fix, and political and social repression he will surely intensify. Raisi does not control Iran's foreign policies, but his presence has already complicated the Biden administration's goal of reviving the 2015 nuclear deal that Donald Trump exited. Given Iran's transformation from a theocracy ruled by Shiite clerics to a military dictatorship ruled by Revolutionary Guards, if Raisi does not become Iran's next powerful clerical leader, he will likely be its last one. Karim Sadjadpour is a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Kamala Harris. A dark portrait here. She looks like she's dressed all in black, which she probably is because it all blends in with a black backdrop. She has her arms crossed in front of her. She's wearing gray beads. She has her hair combed down to her shoulders, bright brown eyes, and she's smiling at the camera. Oh, and she has lots of gold bangles on her wrist. Kamala Harris making history by Nancy Pelosi. When Kamala Harris became vice president, America took a glorious step into the future. Children in America were awakened to new possibilities. People around the world saw America in a new light. There was joy in the air, not just because Kamala Harris was the first woman and first black person and first Asian person to become vice president, but because the country saw what Joe Biden knew, that Kamala Harris was the best. I've known the vice president for a long time. We're Californians with a common motivation, family. The vice president's mother raised her two daughters as she worked as a scientist to cure breast cancer. Her mother's self-determination drives the vice president's work, whether that's providing tangible relief to families, lifting up women in the workforce, or defending the right to vote. The vice president wants everyone to have the opportunity to determine their future. In becoming vice president, Kamala Harris made history, and now she is making progress for the people. Pelosi, a Democrat, is Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Abdul Ghani Barardar, or Barardar, Barradar, by Ahmed Rashid. Mullah Abdul Ghani Barardar is revered among the Taliban as a founding member of the movement in 1994, a charismatic military leader and a deeply pious figure. When the Taliban swept to victory in August in Afghanistan, it was on the terms Barardar negotiated. He was said to be making all the major decisions, including amnesty offered to members of the former regime, the lack of bloodshed when the Taliban entered Kabul, and the regime's contacts and visits with neighboring states, especially China and Pakistan. Now he stands as the fulcrum for the future of Afghanistan. In the interim Taliban government, he was made a deputy prime minister, the top role given to another leader, more acceptable to the younger, more hardline generation of Taliban commanders. A quiet, secretive man who rarely gives public statements or interviews, Barardar nonetheless represents a more moderate current within the Taliban, the one that will be thrust into the limelight to win Western support and desperately needed financial aid. The question is whether the man who coaxed the Americans out of Afghanistan can sway his own movement. Ahmed Rashid is journalist in Pakistan and author of Taliban. Joe Manchin, The Dealmaker by Susan Collins. Manchin is spelled M-A-N-C-H-I-N. My phone rang early the morning after the long 2020 election night. It was Joe Manchin waking me up. He immediately jumped from congratulations to discussing how to reinvigorate bipartisanship in Washington. At the time, we did not know the Senate would be equally divided between Republicans and Democrats, making Joe's vote the most sought after in the Senate. In 2021, Joe's in the midst of every debate. He's front and center on the filibuster issue, the infrastructure debate. Issues from voting laws to immigration to taxes and spending, as well as nearly every appointment made by the president. In short, Joe is the go-to guy in the 50-50 Senate. Joe believes passionately that bipartisanship leads to the best solutions, and he wants to prove it can still work. As someone who shares his belief in working across the aisle, I always want him on my side. Susan Collins is a Republican and a U.S. Senator from Maine. Kim Cook, C-O-O-K, Strategic Thinker by Phil Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. In 2005, when we first talked to Tim Cook about becoming a member of the Nike board, we were hoping to add a good decision maker to the team. Within a short time, he proved himself to be a man of excellent judgment, able to think tactically and strategically in an industry far different from his own. He also offered the most valuable attribute of any leader in any field, wisdom. Outside our work together, I've known Tim as both a friend and as a rival college football fan. The tally since Jim joined Nike's board, Auburn 2 wins, Oregon 0 so far. Virtually all leaders of large organizations today have high IQs. What separates the good from the great are intangibles such as character, compassion, courage, adjectives that apply to Tim. One of his most difficult challenges was the change of leadership at Apple after Steve Jobs passed away. The Steve Jobs who was beloved and recognized around the world as a genius. This almost impossible transition was handled with amazing dignity and grace and announced to the world in his own quiet way. I am not the second Steve Jobs. I am the first Tim Cook. And by the way, in the 10 years since, Apple stock has gone up 1,000%, making it the most valuable company in the world. Knight, the writer, is co-founder and chairman emeritus of Nike. Tom Brady, B-R-A-D-Y, all-time great, by David Beckham. I had always followed Tom Brady's career, but when I came to the States to live and play football, I became a true fan. I'm proud that I also get to call him a great friend. Even if you're not a tennis fan, you want to watch Roger Federer on the court. Even if you do not follow basketball, you know who Michael Jordan is. Tom Brady's an iconic sportsman whom people know, see, and admire. Even if you don't follow American football, you want to watch Tom Brady play, partly because he's so goddamn good-looking. Tom has accomplished the unimaginable. His drive to compete and win is unrivaled. Playing in 9 Super Bowls with the New England Patriots and winning 6 of them was an achievement any athlete would be more than satisfied with, but not Tom. Watching him appear this year in his 10th Super Bowl, this time with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and win, while being named Super Bowl MVP for the 5th time, was a remarkable moment in sporting history. When I think about the peak of athletic excellence, it's hard not to think about Tom Brady. To watch him play is nothing short of inspiring. We can all read the stats and the records he's broken. Tom is and always will be one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play American football. He's a true competitor. His unmatched dedication to the sport, his leadership on the field, his strength both mentally and physically, and his courage are what make Tom Brady a champion and a personal hero of mine. What I and his many friends also see is a great human being, a great father, family man, friend, and partner. He is simply the best, and I cannot wait to see what this next season brings. David Beckham is a member of the English Football Hall of Fame. Angelique Kidjo, K-I-D-J-O. Now, this woman is photographed here in a very sparkly, sequiny, bright blue dress. She's wearing lots of sparkly blue bangles on her right wrist. She has a beautiful scarf wrapped around her head. It's in shades of blue, white, and brown, and the brown matches her skin. And she's wearing dangly, sparkly blue earrings. Angelique Kidjo, Shining Her Light by Alicia Keys. To be able to witness Angelique Kidjo in her element is a gift. When we were collaborating on a song for her latest album, Mother Nature, it felt both magical and natural, like we were sisters in the studio. She taught me how to dance to African music with her and would walk me through the steps and rhythms like an absolute firecracker. Her ability to blend cultures, creating a soulful sound that's out of this world, makes working with her and listening to her so special. It does not matter where you are, you hear her and you become alive. She electrifies people. Through Mother Nature, which features collaborations with the next generation of African musicians, she continues to uphold her mission of bringing forth incredible people and giving them a chance. It's meaningful for someone like Angelique to say to a younger artist, "I love you and you're amazing. Here's an opportunity for everyone to hear you." The grace she exudes toward her fellow creators and to humankind is a reflection of her vibrancy, kindness, and generosity. Angelique is as real as they come. Alicia Keys is a Grammy-winning singer and a film producer. Jensen Huang, H-U-A-N-G. Creating the Future by Andrew Ng. That's NG. Artificial intelligence is transforming our world. The software that enables computers to do things that once required human perception and judgment depends largely on hardware, made possible by Jensen Huang, J-E-N-S-E-N space H-U-A-N-G. In 2003, amid great skepticism, Huang directed his company NVIDIA to adapt chips designed to paint graphics on computer screens, known as graphics processing units or GPUs, to perform other more general purpose computing tasks. The resulting advancements in powerful chips laid a foundation that could accommodate much bigger neural networks, the programs behind much of today's AI. In the process, he's helped enable a revolution that allows phones to answer questions out loud, farms to spray weeds but not crops, doctors to predict the properties of new drugs, with more wonders to come. Huang's gamble paid off largely because he's among the world's most technically savvy CEOs. He's also a compassionate steward of his employees and a generous supporter of education in science and technology. With still emerging AI technologies creating an insatiable hunger for more computation, Huang's team is well positioned to keep driving technological advances for decades to come. Andrew Ng is founder of DeepLearning.ai, founder and CEO of Landing AI, and chairman and co-founder of Coursera. And the final influential person among the 100 of Time's choices is, and it's not really the final one, it's the final one that I've pulled to read, Kathy, C-A-T-H-Y, Park Hong, H-O-N-G, The Empathizer, by Ali Wong. When I read Kathy Park Hong's Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning, it felt like I was being shaken awake to something I had convinced myself was not real. The subtle ways Asian Americans are dismissed, how Asian American women feel the need to apologize when taking up any sort of space. I was also floored by how she described the ripple effect of the Chinese Exclusion Act, how that fear of not wanting to stick out has been passed down through generations, and how this survival tactic limits us and can cause self-hate. And at the same time, Kathy shares stories that feel so personal, so fresh, and so specific, nobody else could have written them. I'd never read a depiction of three contemporary, young, Asian American women that was so complicated, interesting, or full of both love and conflict. Her writing's beautiful, funny, sharp, and most importantly, to a working mother of two who has few brain cells left at the end of the day, easy to read. I annotated the hell out of Minor Feelings. It's the kind of book you want to dog-ear and underline. Reading it was such a crazy feeling. I felt so seen that I could not believe this book existed. and it's become even more painfully relevant in a year in which anti-Asian violence, which has always existed in America, has spiked so aggressively, putting our communities on high alert and searching for solidarity. This is the book to read when you ask me, how can I be an ally? This is the book to read if you want to educate yourself. This is the book to read if you want to be more in touch with your humanity. Ali Wong is a comedian, writer, and actor. From the previous edition of Time, dated September 13/September 2021, The View Opener, The Risk Report, marking 9/11 with an eye toward the future by Ian Bremmer, and even this short article may be abridged. The longest war in U.S. history has come to a close with scenes of violent chaos from Afghanistan. The deaths of U.S. service members and fleeing Afghans will give the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks an especially bitter edge. There are also daily reminders of just how much American domestic politics has changed. The animosities that followed the disputed 2000 U.S. presidential election are tame compared with what's happened over the past 5 years. As Americans mark the 9/11 anniversary and cast a wary eye toward Afghanistan's future, they should remember that what happens next for that country matters far more for many other countries than for the U.S., China, Russia, Iran, and others. For many other countries than for the U.S. China, Russia, Iran, and others will gloat over the withdrawal mess and the U.S. loss of credibility, but they now have many more immediate worries than Americans do. The U.S. withdrawal and Taliban takeover will pose serious problems for Afghanistan's neighbors. Pakistan's military and religious extremists are delighted to see Afghanistan in the hands of an organization they've supported, but now that they're in charge in Kabul, the Taliban are less dependent on Pakistan's goodwill, particularly because they have more options for cash and other resources, China in particular, than they did before NATO arrived in 2001. In addition, Pakistan could soon face a refugee crisis as Afghans flee the Taliban, while extremists within Pakistan could use the Taliban's victory to boost their own cause. Vladimir Putin enjoyed the humiliating U.S. retreat, but instability in Afghanistan threatens Russia, which continues to list the Taliban as a terrorist group. The governments of Central Asian states Uzbekistan and Tajikistan are right to fear a potential wave of refugees if anti-Taliban resistance continues to grow in Afghanistan's north. No country in the neighborhood has changed more over the past 20 years than China, which will now, for the first time, play an active role in trying to keep Afghanistan stable. Beijing needs to ensure Afghanistan does not become a haven for extremists, angered by China's persecuted Uyghur ethnic minority, and a launchpad for terrorist attacks there or anywhere in China. Beijing also fears a spillover of violence from Afghanistan into Central Asia, where China has invested heavily in infrastructure projects. As Americans pause to reflect all that's changed inside their country and for the U.S. role in the world over the past 20 years, understanding the limits of U.S. interests in Afghanistan should play a role in how they think about the next 20 years. The greatest failure since 9/11 comes not from the inability to build democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's in the failure of our leaders and the American people to carry forward the unity that existed after the attack to help the U.S. build a more perfect union. It did not last, of course, but there was a brief moment when Americans were reminded of all they have in common. The question we must answer is whether those days are gone for good. A few lines from The City That Endures by Stephanie Zakarik. If New York is a city of reinvention, it's also a place of perpetual wistfulness, of missing people and things that are gone. Every day, even in the best of times, something you love about New York disappears. Your favorite restaurant can't hack it. The awesome little card store had to close because people stopped sending cards. With life comes attrition. The guy who used to fix your shoes just got old, and one day he died. There was no one to take over his business. Those of us who live here now, as the city tries to shimmer back to life amid the seemingly endless COVID crisis, feel that toothache of the heart every time we pass one of our many shuttered storefronts. Yet those of us who lived here on 9/11 and continue to live here today have an advantage. We once saw in our city a smoking hole that also served as a mass grave for lives and flesh that had been incinerated in a flash on a gorgeous late summer day. Once you've seen what your city can do in the wake of that, you understand it as a place of awe as well as sorrow. Against all odds, it always comes back. We barely speak to one another, but when we link arms, watch out. The memorial is everyone who stayed. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.